Before we get into today's episode, I want you to imagine something. It's 1862. Salt Lake City is a frontier outpost, and there are roughly 12,000 people living here. And remember, there's no transcontinental railroad, no electricity. The Salt Lake Temple, the building that would become the defining symbol of the entire civilization, is not even close to finished.
And yet, in March of that year, more than 1,200 people crammed into the most elegant building in the entire Utah Territory to watch a play. And the building they were sitting in was, by some accounts, finer than anything between St. Louis and San Francisco.
Today we're telling the full story of the Salt Lake Theater. How it got built, what happened inside its walls for 66 years, who performed there, and what it meant to the people who loved it, and why, in 1928, a wrecking crew showed up and spent weeks trying to tear it down, because it was so well built that it refused to fall. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Okay, nerds. There are the Mormon history nerds out there, but did you know that there's an entirely other group of Mormon nerds out there that exist? We should arm wrestle them. Probably, these nerds are probably, dare I say, more robust than our kind. What kind of nerds could those be? Why, those are the Mormon theater nerds. You've met them. They're the ones that break out a hymn at the family party. The ones that have to sit down and play the song on the piano for you. If you're one of those nerds, just know that all of us don't always enjoy that. I think a lot of people don't fully appreciate how deeply embedded theater was in the early Mormon culture. Like, this was not a reluctant concession. This was a genuine love.
Right. And obviously, it doesn't start in Utah. It goes back further than that. Before the Exodus, in Nauvoo, the early 1840s, Joseph Smith himself organized a dramatic company. There's a cultural hall on Main Street. People are putting on plays. This is a community that is doing theater while simultaneously building a temple and a city.
And Brigham Young was in it. He was actually on stage, not just a pulpit. He was in the theater.
True or false, you told me that is your number one time machine desire. If you can go back in time, you want to see Brigham Young.
Honestly, I would do that. I don't know that that's number one, but I'd say top 10 for sure.
You said it was number one. Don't try to lie to the people now. Yeah, no, Brigham Young on stage. It's April 1844, just 2 months before Joseph and Hiram Smith will be killed. Brigham Young played the high priest in a production of Pizarro, or The Death of Rolla. He was costumed in, and you have to love this detail, robes of scarlet and gold with white muslin in a non-speaking part. The show must go on, I guess.
Which, it feels exactly right for Brigham Young, honestly. I would go see that. Death of Pizarro, that sounds great. Would I want to see a sermon? No. No. I'll just read the shorthand on that. But
make theater great again?
Make theater Brigham again. And Norton, no, I take that back. Don't make anything Brigham again. We're fine with the Brigham gone. But, you know, he probably had an enormous presence, no lines required. And in the same production, there was a young man working as a stagehand named Hiram Clawson. Now, remember that name because he's going to come back in a major way. So the Saints really carry this theater tradition with them on the trail west. They loved it in Nauvoo. They take it across. We hear stories of them doing it on the trail. And You know, during this exodus, they're doing all kinds of things. There are accounts of makeshift stages on the open ground, performances done on wagon beds. And one historian wrote that, quote, "Even in these, the darkest days of Mormon history, the innate love of the people for a clean and wholesome social enjoyment lightened their cares and eased their burdens."
Can you try to at least make it sound interesting still, Guy? Like this clean and wholesome enjoyment. They enjoyed it. It was still fun.
Well, okay, to be fair, what else are you going to do? You're like stuck there. You're like, no, I'm going to go wander in the wilderness
hoeing
more.
Hoeing potatoes, clean, wholesome enjoyment.
And, you know, and back to my little lecture at the opening of this, you know who you are. You might be the one that is like, well, I'm a really good pianist. Anyone would be lucky to hear me play at the Super Bowl party at grandma's house. No, like sometimes I just want to talk about Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. I don't want to have to hear my uncle get on the piano and sing a tune for us all. And so if you're that guy, stop doing that. But if you're stuck on a wedding or a wagon train and you have that one guy, he's with you the whole way. And you know what you get? You get him every night for your recreation and there's nothing you can do about it. So I guess there's something really beautiful and human about it. I am in filmmaking now. I appreciate the craft. I love that Mormonism as a storytelling element has helped me with that. So people suffering, people uncertain of their future, they're putting on plays, they're transmuting that, even if you have to deal with the one guy who just won't stop singing.
All of that, that's what humans do. That's why it matters to understanding why the Salt Lake Theater eventually gets built. It's a continuation of something that was already alive in the community. The first pioneers arrived in Salt Lake Valley in July 1847. By 1850, 3 years later, there are plays being performed under the boughs of the original Bowery on Temple Square. People were starving, having a rough time finding food, but as we said, the show must go on.
And we've talked about this in earlier episodes when we talk about the endowment and old W.W. Phelps writhing around like a snake, like really getting into the Satan role, which I think is telling. But the saints did not draw a hard line between the sacred and the performative in the same ways that later Protestant sensibilities might. And so Brigham Young famously said, quote, "There is nothing lovely in this world, but the Lord created it for the good of his children. It is the abuse and not the use of anything that constitutes evil." Well, that's an interesting quote coming from Brigham Young. And I want to sit with that for a second because it's actually a pretty radical idea in the context of 19th century American religious culture. Most of the reform movements coming out of New England at this time are deeply suspicious of theater because it's associated with vice, with loose morals, with the kind of people who drink in public. And here's the prophet of a new American religion saying, "God made beauty, go enjoy it."
And which prophet? This is such an interesting part of Brigham Young character, because if you're going to pick somebody in this time frame who's going to advocate for arts and theater and dancing and things like that, it's really not Brigham Young you think of. It is a very interesting part of his character, I think.
And I will say,
and he's conflicted about it too.
In the spirit of a fairness, I know I crap on this guy all the time, but like I do appreciate that he had an appreciation for dancing and theater. There, I said it. There's something I appreciate about Brigham Young. I really do. And Brigham liked to dance with the gents, with the ladies, but mostly with the gents. And I think his love of theater, as you're going to see, pays off.
Yeah, because there's another reason they're doing this. All of this does also build a case, and this will matter politically for the Mormons for decades. This is telling the larger nation that Mormons are a civilized, refined people, and theater is right at the center of that argument. So in 1852, the Deseret Dramatic Association is formed. Brigham Young is an honorary member. They build a social hall. It's 40 by 60 feet, about 300 seats in there. They have a bust of Shakespeare on the stage, tallow candles for footlights. It's small, it's modest, it's real though, like they're trying. The orchestra is directed by a guy named Domenico Bali, who had previously been the bandmaster at West Point. How does that happen? How do you have the West Point bandmaster in Salt Lake City in the middle of nowhere in 1852?
Well, converts are coming from everywhere, and that's one of the things that gets lost in the pioneer narrative sometimes, that this was an international cosmopolitan migration. So you've got your London trained architects, your former military musicians, your skilled artisans from all over the world, mostly Europe, pouring into the valley. And then the Utah War. In 1857, Johnson's army marches in and activities at the social hall cease for a time. And for a few years, the community's theatrical life kind of goes quiet. although somewhat hilariously, the soldiers at Camp Floyd immediately build their own theater. If you've ever seen The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, I don't know if you've seen that movie. It is a, you know, sort of absurdist, dramatized version of this, but it does show you the limits of theater in the West, which I think is worth watching.
Then in 1859, a new company forms, the Mechanics Dramatic Association. A man named Harry Bowering offers the ground floor of his unfinished home on 100 South as a makeshift theater. They have rugs and sheets for scenery at first, then calico curtains, and then they actually have painted sets as they get a little more money coming in. One evening, Brigham Young and Counselor Heber C. go to see a show there, a play called Luke the Laborer. Brigham Young loves it so much, he comes back the next night, bringing his entire family of 90 people.
I love that his favorite play was called Luke the Laborer. He likes to watch people work. Big surprise.
Look at that guy build that chair. What a carpenter.
And it's a biblical name from the Bible. So he brings 90 people. How did they all fit in the minivan? That's what I always wonder. So 90 people show up for the second night performance at the theater, which is literally the unfinished ground floor of somebody's house. So they're all squeezing people in, and Young makes his curtain speech that night and is so inspired that he turns immediately to Hiram Clausen. Clausen, who had been a stagehand in Nauvoo, remember him, and he tells him, you need to find a site for a proper theater. And just like that, the Salt Lake Theater begins.
Let's talk about the theater building itself because, again, in the middle of nowhere, the time it's built, it's genuinely extraordinary. Planning and construction of the Salt Lake Theater is definitely one of the more remarkable feats of pioneer-era Utah, and it deserves real attention. So, set the scene for us. What's Salt Lake City look like in 1861?
Okay, like I mentioned, it's a frontier settlement of about 12,000 people. There is no transcontinental railroad, because that doesn't come until the end of the 1860s. There are no established supply lines for building materials, so it's really what they bring across or what they can, like, you know, forge from the mountains. The Salt Lake Temple is under construction and nowhere near done, and Brigham Young decides that the community needs most urgently is this first-class world theater. And this creates a genuine controversy. Some church leaders felt that building a theater before completing the temple was theologically questionable.
Remember, go back to Nauvoo, though. Joseph Smith says we're building a temple, but we're also building the Nauvoo House. It's going to be a nice place where we can entertain the muckety-mucks that come through here, right? It is an interesting dynamic that goes back to his predecessor, that yes, temple, but also entertainment, hospitality, that kind of thing.
Well, when you're gathering the world in your theological sense of, you know, this is going to be the center of everything, maybe when Jesus comes, you need a really cool movie theater to do it in. But I also think that there's this question of, like, are you prioritizing secular entertainment over sacred architecture? And of course, Young dismisses these concerns. His position was essentially, listen, these people need recreation. Entertainment is not a luxury. It's a necessity.
And if you read between the lines here, you've also got something practical going on. Because by 1861, Young has been watching tourism to Salt Lake explode. Again, this goes back to Joseph Smith's idea. These years before the railroad is announced, you've got a bunch of people coming through, and he knows that when the railroad is completed, the world will absolutely begin to arrive. Building something refined and grand is part of how you're going to shape the narrative of your community. We'll definitely come back to the politics of that. But yes, our groundbreaking for the Salt Lake Theater happens in July 1861, and you're not surprised, here's where the community character comes through. Nearly every family in Salt Lake City will contribute in one way or another. Workers take clay from the benches above the city, they mix it with straw and gravel, and make adobe bricks, Brigham Young's favorite building material. Up to 250,000 adobe bricks. The indentations left by this brick making is so large that for several years after, the locals would skate in this random pond in the winter that was created.
I actually really love that detail. It's kind of cool.
And the structural timbers of the massive red pine beams are hauled from Big Cottonwood Canyon, 25 miles south of the city. The foundation stones come out of Red Butte Canyon, but again, they're in the middle of nowhere, you don't have great supply lines, they're short on nails. So the workers will actually scavenge iron from burned government wagons left on the Wyoming desert from the Utah War.
And again, I love this. Like, this is resourcefulness, but this is also kind of petty too. They're like building a temple of high culture out of their enemy's wreckage.
There's a nice little metaphor somewhere
there's I'm sure Brigham Young made full use of it. Don't worry.
And there's another funding source in the middle of all this that's almost too perfect. Same kind of idea. So when the army is suddenly redeployed east to fight in this thing called the Civil War, the government auctions off enormous quantities of surplus supplies. They have put a ton of material out here in the middle of nowhere. So Brigham Young sends Hiram Claussen to the auction with $4,000 in gold. Claussen talks about how he's buying tents and cook stoves. Top of the line, they sell for $12 in New York City. It's a dollar. It's like those stupid auction commercials you constantly see. I got a PlayStation for 34 cents. This is your 1861 equivalent. Nails, $40 a box back there, $6. He ends up turning a portion of those purchases for $40,000 in profit.
That's right. The United States Army literally funds the Salt Lake Theater. Good job, guys.
Yeah, pretty much. They're taking full advantage of the army's largesse here. Women in the evenings, after they finish up the chores, will whittle hundreds of wooden pegs needed to tie the roof spans together. Former sailors, guys who are very much used to working at the heights of ship's masts, will complete the upper levels at Brigham Young's personal request.
It's genuinely a community-built structure. I wish we would have heard stories about them, you know, whittling pegs instead of just smashing at the china for the temple, because this is cool. One historian wrote that, quote, Nearly every family residing in Great Salt Lake City at the time was represented on the roster of workmen.
So they've got the walls up by October 1861. The building is enclosed by Christmas, and then it's finished enough for a formal dedication on March 6th, 1862. Total cost? Over $100,000. In 1862, for essentially a poor agricultural community, this is a lot of money. So let's talk about what they built. The architect of the exterior is William Folsom, who will go on to become the architect of the Salt Lake Temple. His daughter, Amelia, will become a favorite wife of Brigham Young.
Pet, you mean? I'm sorry, wife, yes. Pet, wife, same thing.
Something, no kids. She's the fun, cool one, apparently. She will get the coolest house on the face of the planet built for her that we will 100%
talk about. What happens when Daddy built a theater for Uncle Brig?
The types of cool buildings that get built are very interesting. And then the interior of the Salt Lake Theater is designed by a guy named E.L.T. Harrison. He's the London-trained architect and a recent convert to the church, and he patterns it after the famous Drury Lane Theater.
Yeah, so the interior is modeled after the Drury Lane, and in the Utah desert, that's kind of crazy to think about. Remember, they're still starving. The exterior is described as chaste and elegant. Just like myself. Two Doric columns commanding the entrance, chalky white plaster that one early visitor said looked magical at nightfall. And inside it's something else. It's a comfortable parquet level, four ascending tiers of balconies, a dress circle, three upper galleries, two private boxes overlooking the stage, all in a horseshoe configuration that created extraordinary acoustics, and the stage was 130 feet deep, and one theatrical promoter later described it as, quote, the most capacious of any in the country. In America, this is the most spacious stage.
They have a movable floor that could cover up that parquet and turn the whole space into a ballroom. 40 cotillions could dance at once, Wilford Woodruff noted breathlessly after the opening.
Breathlessly.
This is a space. They have fun in here. The building is 144 feet long, 80 feet wide, seating 1,500 people. If you're paying attention, that's more than 10% of your entire population.
And almost 10% of Brigham's family. But a mom.
That's as long as the kids were, you know, seated properly. Like, you could get them all in. It took some work, but everybody could fit. Like, this is a massive undertaking. British journalist William Hepworth Dixon, who's not easy to impress and not really a Mormon sympathizer, called it a model playhouse with perfect light and scrupulous cleanliness. Again, you have to remember, this is the 1860s. Everything is gross and dirty. It's dusty. It's muddy. They took care of this place. Speaker of the House Schuyler Colfax came through in 1865 and said he'd never seen anything better in a theater. Samuel Bowles, editor of the Springfield Republican, who in the same breath was deeply critical of Mormons, wrote something remarkable. He said, quote, "No eastern city of 100,000 inhabitants, remember, Salt Lake City is less than 20,000, possesses so fine a theatrical structure. It ranks, alike in capacity and elegance, along with the opera houses and academies of music of Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Cincinnati."
So they built a theater that New York couldn't even beat with adobe bricks and scavenged, whittled nails in the desert. When Henry Miller gave the dedication speech, he called it, quote, "the cathedral in the desert." And that name stuck for the rest of its existence. So talk about the dedication night.
So it's March 6th, 1862. Brigham Young sends out invitations that are both formal and handwritten, specifying that children under four are not admitted, which seems very aggressive in a Mormon culture, urging guests to dress warmly because the interior is not quite fully finished yet. Over 1,200 people attend, mostly church leaders and their families. It's the muckety-muck night.
And then Daniel H. Wells gives the dedicatory prayer, which by all accounts is an extremely thorough prayer. His wife, Louisa, exhausted by it, wonders afterwards if he couldn't have, quote, left out some of the lathe and plaster.
It would be really interesting to do a study of dedicatory prayers because it is a very specific genre of speech. This one, early temple dedication prayers, like meeting house ones, they don't leave things out.
And like, I just want to remind you, the guy who dedicates the theater is also the guy that like massacres 100 Timpanogos. Like, it's just weird to think about Daniel H. Wells, who runs the Nauvoo Legion, that he is also just giving off too long prayers that even offend his own wives.
He goes through every material component of the building. No joke. He includes the foundations, the walls, the floors, the doors, the windows, the timber, the nails, the glass, blessing all of them in turn. One of the most granular prayers in Mormon history.
It's almost like hypervigilance comes from as a trauma response from something. I wonder what that could be. And then Young speaks and he says what will become the defining statement of the theater philosophy, quote, "If I had my way, I would never have a tragedy played on these boards. There's enough of tragedy in everyday life and we ought to have amusement when we come here."
All of his wives are like, "Here, here, Brother Brigham." The choir and the orchestra then play the Star-Spangled Banner, La Marseillaise, a special anthem written for the occasion by Eliza R. Snow, and some hymns, and then they go forth in the dance.
And of course, as we mentioned, Brigham Young, he loved himself a good dance.
The first play they perform in the new theater is called The Pride of the Market. Not the most dramatic name in theater history.
You know, we need Christopher Blythe to AI Brigham Young doing the Macarena. Chris, that's a request, please. Okay, but you know what? I appreciate starting with something modest. Save the Shakespeare for a week or two, Mormons. So the theater's built. Now we have to talk about how Brigham Young actually ran the place, because for me, this is where things get genuinely fascinating and also a little bit chaotic.
Interestingly, I mean, maybe not given what we've already told you, Brigham Young is deeply involved in the day-to-day operation of the theater. He attends a bunch of rehearsals. He reportedly used his personal carriage to take actresses to and from the theater so they wouldn't be subjected to unwanted attention. If you are a real devoted longtime listener, you may recall way back when in the Year of Polygamy days, when we talked about Annalisa Webb, she was one of them. The unwanted attention for Brigham means people not named Brigham Young. And all of that sounds protective and also controlling in a very Brigham Young kind of way. For what it's worth, he was also a splendid fireman by one account. So there's a story one night, someone is giving a lecture at the theater and a couple of the coal oil footlights start smoking and then flare up dangerously. Brigham Young sneaks out of the box quietly, walks over, puts out the light with his broad-brimmed hat, and goes back to his seat without a word. Just solves the problem. Doesn't make a scene. The show must go on.
He's a hero, dare we say.
The hero that we deserve.
That might be true. Okay, the rules of the theater were strict and comprehensive. No alcohol in the theater, ever. Unless Young gave you direct permission. No smoking, no profanity, and no tragedy. Customers were required to check their firearms at the box office. Utah in the 1860s. You had to check in your firearms. That's just what
you Utah. Too, Lott Smith. Give me all the pistols, everything.
It's not that much different than Utah and Southern Utah in 2026, let's be honest. Instead of popcorn, the audience ate parched corn and dried fruit. And if you couldn't afford a ticket, which many couldn't in the early years, almost anything was accepted in exchange. You could trade for eggs, butter, cheese, flowers, vegetables, large melons bought a ticket, a small melon in change. Ain't that life, though. The most Utah sentence I've ever heard.
And the house rules posted there included fines for everything. 50 cents for being absent from a scene during rehearsal. $5 for missing a full rehearsal. A week's salary for appearing intoxicated on stage. $1 for restoring something that was cut by the management. I like that one. Or for ad-libbing. No improv, kids. Brigham Young was essentially the first stage manager in Utah history, and he was not playing around. Early actors were largely unpaid amateurs who were expected to learn 3, 4, sometimes 5 new plays a week. Frequently, 2 plays on the same night, sometimes memorizing their parts with a single day's notice. And their dedication to this thing is remarkable. And the community response to it is real. In the first 8 years of the theater's existence, it produced more than 500 plays, farces, and operas. One chronicler called it a record unequaled by any American theater of that time.
Okay, so now let's talk about the censorship, because it's understandable and also wild, and I think it's affected Mormon art to this day. Young's dislike of tragedies was absolute. He did not want women and children leaving the theater with feelings of fear and anxiety, because that's what the pulpit was for. He didn't want horror. He didn't want the grotesque, because life as Mormon on the frontier had plenty of that already.
One Blood Atonement sermon a week was good enough.
Seriously, I think that's part of it. Like, when I heard this, I was like, that is some interesting psychology. It seems like genuinely paternalistic, but also you kind of understand it in the context, because life did really suck, and so he wanted to make it fun. I wish he would have taken that advice into his sermons. But remember, these are people who had been expelled from Ohio, from Missouri, expelled from Illinois. They walked across a continent. They had seen a lot of tragedy, and they didn't need to pay 50 cents for more of it.
Then, in 1869, something happens that really illustrates this. A well-known actress named Lucille Western comes through playing Nancy Sykes in an adaptation of Oliver Twist. By all accounts, her murder scene was extraordinary. It was performed with, quote, such terrible fidelity, one reviewer wrote, that it became absolutely loathsome. The audience revolted at the ghastly mimicry of a bloody murder.
And what does Young do? He shuts it down.
He forbids that one to be performed again. He orders the bishops to denounce the play from the pulpit the following Sunday.
It's giving Larry H. Miller Brokeback Mountain. So he's using the Sunday sermon to do theater criticism, and this is why I didn't see The Godfather until I was in my 30s.
He will frame this as protecting the community's mental and spiritual health. He wanted productions to make, quote, spectators feel well and improve the public mind and exalt the literary taste of the community.
And here, in my opinion, is where Mormon art gets absolutely crippled forever. Brigham makes sure that he sets a standard that art should elevate, not degrade. It should show virtue triumphing over vice. And it seems like a giant projection of one man that ruins it for the rest of us.
Just read a really good biography of Walt Disney recently, and this has a lot of that in it. It's a lot of him projecting himself through what is produced around him.
It's almost like prophets project all the time.
And the tension, of course, is that don't show the dark side of humanity is a position that's really hard to maintain in legitimate theater. A, you can't produce Shakespeare without tragedy. B, you can't produce serious drama without showing human feeling. And this will eventually be the undoing of this vision he has for the place. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's tell some stories.
Yes, the stories, please.
All right, so there's one about the young actor who fell in love with Sarah Alexander, a ward of Young's. He went to Young to ask permission to court her. Young told him, "Young man, I've seen you attempt Richard III and Julius Caesar with fair success, but I advise you not to aspire to Alexander."
Ouch. And then there's the ballet story, the first professional ballet company to appear at the theater. Young instructs the manager that all ballet skirts must be ankle length. And the manager protests that the dancers can't perform in ankle-length skirts. But Young is insistent. So for the first performance, dancers are tripping and falling on their skirts. So the manager cuts 1 inch off before the second performance. And when Young doesn't notice, he cuts another inch and keeps going 1 inch at a time. This is what we call the slippery slope. Until by the final night of the run, the skirts are back to their original lengths. And Young had attended every performance and either didn't notice or pretended he hadn't. And can you imagine going against someone with the power of Brigham Young in this way? I love it so much. So ladies, 1 inch at a time, baby.
Really interesting. Friend of the podcast, Nancy Ross, has just published a book on Mormon garments.
That's exactly what happened.
a history of men designing clothes for women who they just don't get it.
You know what's interesting, Mormon ladies out there? Dressing without the help of a committee sometime. You should try it.
All right. Speaking of Brigham Young's power to extract obedience, we also have a story of an actress who needed a dark-haired wig and couldn't find one in the wardrobe. So Brigham Young approaches an actor named John McDonald, who has long black hair, and asks him to cut it for the wig. McDonald said, "If the success of the play depends upon my hair, Brother Brigham, you shall have it," and chopped off his hair.
He's our own Samson. And then there's the matter of the soldiers. In August of 1864, a group of soldiers from Fort Douglas are refused entry to the theater. The Mormons do not like the soldiers in the 1860s. The official reason is never recorded, but a newspaper reporter suggests it's because theater management was worried about soldiers harassing the women in the audience. And the Union Vedette, which is the soldiers' newspaper, is furious. They write that the exclusion was causeless, indecent, and impudent. And they accuse Young of letting bigotry blind his patriotism, and they call the theater's rules un-American.
It's an interesting accusation to level at a guy who's running a theater where they open every single performance with prayer and play the Star Spangled Banner at dedications. We want you to be American. No, not like that, like us.
The Mormon-American identity tension runs through this entire story, and that's something worth keeping in mind as we move forward.
All right, one more character before we move on. Let's talk about Maude Adams and her mother. Annie Adams Kiskaden was a leading lady at the Salt Lake Theater for years, and her daughter Maude makes her stage debut as a literal infant in the early 1870s. There's this great chaotic story where a production calls for a baby on stage. Property man couldn't get one, and just as everything is falling apart, Annie walks up with baby Maude in her arms and says, "Here's Maude, you can use her."
And Maude Adams grew up to be one of the most famous actresses in America. She was the original Peter Pan on Broadway, and she started on that stage in Salt Lake City because her mother needed a prop.
That's quite a real lineage running from the Pioneer Theater Company through Maude Adams on the American stage. That's not nothing.
Far beyond emancipators and the lowliest together in their stalls. I hear them all, I hear them all, I hear them all.
Okay, let's take a step back here and put the theater in some historical context, because that's actually one of the most interesting parts of the story. So let's talk about what the theater meant, not just to the saints, but in terms of the Mormons' position in the national imagination.
So we need to briefly describe what was happening to the Mormon reputation in the 1850s and 1860s, because it's relevant here, and it directly shapes why this building exists. Remember that in 1852, the church publicly announces the practice of polygamy, and the national reaction is volcanic. The Republican Party in 1856 declares polygamy and slavery the famous twin relics of barbarism, and Stephen Douglas gives a speech comparing Mormonism to a pestiferous, disgusting cancer, which is gnawing into the very vitals of the body politic. And the national press depicts Mormons as simultaneously despotic and licentious. And there is an entire genre of erotic Mormon thriller movies.
Don't worry. It's more germane to our topic. The Eastern Theater will get in on this too. So in 1858, the very year that the Utah War is starting to wind down, a New York playwright named Thomas Dunn English opens a play at Burton's Theater called The Mormons, or Life in Salt Lake City. It depicts Parley P. Pratt as a villain who uses the Danites to terrorize Gentiles and seduce innocent women into plural marriage. Later, after John D. Lee is executed as the scapegoat for the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 1877, a play called The Danites in the Sierras becomes the most commercially successful anti-Mormon drama ever staged, and it will run for years.
So while Eastern theaters are producing these images of Mormons as bloodthirsty polygamists, Brigham Young is in the Salt Lake City building a Drury Lane replica in the desert.
It's not a coincidence.
You could argue the theater is a counter-argument. It's a physical statement that says, we are refined people. We have culture. We have taste. We are not savages.
One of the great long-standing ironies of Mormon history is that Mormons need Eastern tourists to like them for both political and economic reasons, and at the same time, the Eastern tourist industry to Utah is running on the mythology of the dangerous exotic Mormon.
Tourists were coming to Salt Lake by the tens of thousands after the railroad in 1869, and a lot of them came expecting to see something scandalous. The cab drivers, mostly non-Mormon Gentiles, would point out houses supposedly built for multiple wives, which is exactly what happens when I drive down the street with anyone in my car. People peered up at the Lion House trying to count smoke plumes from the chimneys to guess how many wives were home.
And Mark Twain captures this perfectly in Roughing It. His party walking the streets of Salt Lake City, quote, surreptitiously staring at every creature we took to be a Mormon, feeling like they were in a fairyland, a land of enchantment and goblins and awful mystery. Then, when they actually get to the theater, they find, like had been described, this model playhouse. Extraordinary acoustics, an orderly audience, and classical performances. The church leaders had made deliberate strategic decisions to use culture, like the tabernacle choir, the temple grounds, the theater. These are all instruments of public relations. Apostle George Q. Cannon basically said, let them come here and see that we are not what they imagine. We are going to display our refinement publicly.
And the theater was the most visible, most legible form of that argument because every visiting dignitary, every newspaper correspondent who came through, Speaker of the House Colfax, Samuel Bowles, Bishop Sheepshanks from England all went to the theater and they all came away impressed.
Bishop John Sheepshanks, visiting from his Norwich, England rectory, initially refused Brigham Young's invitation because, you know, this is a Church of England bishop at the Mormon Theater. Brigham Young tells him, quote, if you come to our theater, you need not leave your religion at the door. So Sheepshanks goes. He is so charmed, he goes home wishing England had entertainment of that sort. Then, after Brigham Young's death in 1877, there is a shift at the theater. Without his hand on it, the repertoire loosens. That secularizing trend he had been holding back will start to move. By the 1880s, the 1890s, as the railroad has now pulled the theater into the national booking circuit, New York agencies start controlling what comes through. Brigham Young would have hated this.
Which is a real changing of the guard. The theater that was built as a statement of Mormon self-determination becomes, slowly, a venue controlled by New York booking agents. Ain't that always how it is? And the national stars who come through are extraordinary. We've got Edwin Booth, Sarah Bernhardt, Lillian Russell, Al Jolson, Buffalo Bill Cody, the Barrymore family, yes, that Barrymore family, Ethel, John and Lionel, P.T. Barnum, and my absolute favorite, Oscar Wilde, gives a lecture there. Oscar Wilde, my guy in Salt Lake City. And I want to take a slight detour to talk about these actors at this time to tell you how remarkable they were and how lucky Utah was to have them.
All right, first up is Edwin Booth. Considered the greatest Shakespearean actor of the 19th century, he's also the brother of John Wilkes Booth, of course, the assassin of Abraham Lincoln. He spends much of his career trying to rehabilitate the family name through the nobility of his art. His Hamlet is so definitive it runs for 100 consecutive nights on Broadway, a record at that time. Then, the French actress Sarah Bernhardt, known as the Divine Sarah, widely considered the first international celebrity in the modern sense of it. She's famous for sleeping in a satin-lined coffin to commune with death for her tragic roles. Brigham Young is like, no tragedies! She would continue performing even after her leg was amputated in 1915. When she was told that she shouldn't tour America because Americans were too uncultured, she reportedly said that the money was cultured enough. That's a great response.
Oh my gosh, I love her. And another actress that played in the Salt Lake Theater was Lillian Russell. And she was the most famous beauty in America in the 1880s and 90s. A singer and an actress whose hourglass figure was considered the ideal of feminine attractiveness. She was also one of the first celebrities to openly advocate for women's physical fitness and rode a gold-plated bicycle through Central Park as a publicity stunt. Her personal life was spectacularly chaotic, with 4 marriages and a decades-long relationship with Diamond Jim Brady. And the entertainer Al Jolson, who played in the theater in its last years, he was a singer and comedian who starred in The Jazz Singer in 1927, the first major sound film. He was also a deeply controversial figure whose career was built substantially on blackface performance, which casts a long shadow over his legacy.
Of course, many of you heard of William Cody, a.k.a. Buffalo Bill Cody. He's an Army scout turned showman whose Wild West touring spectacular really kind of invents the mythology of the American West for mass audiences in America and definitely in Europe. He took his show to Queen Victoria's Golden Jubilee in 1887. He was, interestingly, ahead of his time on women's rights, and he also employed Native American performers at a time when many argued he was simultaneously exploiting and preserving their cultures.
We mentioned the Barrymores also performed at the theater, Ethel John and Lionel Barrymore. The first family of the American stage, grandchildren of the actress Mrs. John Drew, who had herself played at the Salt Lake Theater, meaning 4 generations of that family appeared on the stage. Ethel was the grand dame of the American theater. John was considered the greatest Hamlet of his generation, and later a Hollywood leading man of legendary handsomeness. And Lionel won an Oscar and became one of Hollywood's most beloved character actors. And of course, Drew Barrymore is their great-grandniece.
And ever heard of P.T. Barnum? The great American showman, self-proclaimed Prince of Humbug, who understood that people will pay to be wonderfully deceived. His American Museum in New York displayed curiosities including the Fiji mermaid, a monkey's torso sewn to a fishtail, which he advertised with absolute shamelessness. He, of course, is often credited with the phrase, "There's a sucker born every minute," even though he probably never said it. He played at this theater also.
The 1880s and 1890s are really the peak of the theater. The Transcontinental Railroad has now made Salt Lake a regular stop in the national circuit, so there was a major 1873 renovation that updated the interior into proper European opera house style with gas lighting, new chairs, modified floor for better sightlines. I have to say, though, candlelight theater would have been rad. The theater had 4 ascending tiers and that horseshoe configuration that creates this famous intimacy and the extraordinary acoustics that we talked about. And of course, the stars are still coming.
Julia Dean Hain is a wonderful story. She's a famous American actress who comes through Salt Lake City planning a brief visit. She loves it so much, the theater, the audiences, the whole experience, she will end up staying for over a year. At her farewell performance in July 1866, she steps out of character for a minute to give a speech directly to the audience. She thanks President Young for the many courtesies to a stranger, alone and unprotected, says she wished the same, quote, "purity prevailed in every temple for the drama's teaching." And if you listen, she's acknowledging that a woman traveling alone in the 1860s is very much a vulnerable position, and this community had actually been good to her.
You might not know this, but one of my favorite books, probably my most favorite book of all time, is The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde, the Irish poet, playwright, and the wit who arrived in America in January 1882 for a lecture tour, reportedly telling custom officials he had, quote, "nothing to declare but my genius," which is very Oscar Wilde. He's known throughout the world as the Sunflower Apostle, with a special thanks to Mormons.
He is basically the living embodiment of the aesthetic movement that held that beauty itself was the highest purpose of art and human life. The sunflower had become so synonymous with him and aestheticism that Punch magazine will caricature him as a sunflower, and a craze for planting them kind of sweeps America and England in his wake. And to prepare audiences for his arrival, Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta Patience, which satirized the aesthetic movement and featured a character that was widely understood to be based on Wilde, is performed all over the country. Salt Lake Theater, no exception. They staged it over 100 times, selling out many nights. So Salt Lake City knew who Oscar Wilde was long before he set foot in Utah. You could say they'd been rehearsing for him.
So he arrives on the morning train on April 10th, 1882, conspicuously not wearing his famous bottle green knee breeches, to the visible disappointment of those gathered at the station. He was, the Deseret News reported, quote, observed of all observers. He disappeared through the ladies' entrance of the Walker House Hotel, took lunch alone in his room with only his servant, and then paid a visit to LDS Church President John Taylor, touring the city with him. Quote, Oscar, seeing as much as possible and being seen as little as possible, was the quote. He was not impressed with Taylor. He wrote to a friend afterwards that the tabernacle was shaped like a soup kettle with decorations suitable for a jail. And remember, he's coming from high art in Europe. He's like literally the leader of the aesthetic movement, and he comes to Utah. And that evening, the crowd gathered at the Salt Lake Theater, and when Wilde finally stepped on stage in his full aesthetic regalia and looked down at the front row, he stopped. He seemed disconcerted, the account says, because seated in the front row were young men, all of them wearing enormous sunflowers on their lapels, every single one.
So what happened that moment is one of the quietly extraordinary scenes in Salt Lake City history, because these dudes on the front row knew exactly what they were doing. The sunflower is not really a decorative choice, but it's a coded language that men who loved men used to recognize one another in a world that does not yet have a safe vocabulary for what they were. Harvard freshman had done the same thing at his Boston lecture a few months earlier, dressing in aesthetic costume and filling the front rows with sunflowers. In Salt Lake City, the heart of a theocratic Mormon settlement in the Utah desert, someone had organized a front row.
Yeah, I really love this story. It's like a moment for LGBT folks. Like, and if you know anything about Oscar Wilde's history with being a homosexual in England, it's already rough. And so I imagine coming to frontier Mormon Utah was kind of nerve-wracking. And so that must have felt nice to have a row of sunflower boys in the front. Wilde, to his credit, addressed them directly from stage, saying he could see, quote, certain signs of an aesthetic movement, and, quote, certain young men who are no doubt sincere. And this, of course, is all coded. And then he gave his halting, nervous lecture to an audience that largely found him baffling. Let's just say they weren't a good match. The Deseret News called his ideas unoriginal and absurd. How dare they? The Herald said there was, quote, no attempt at enthusiasm. Wilde later told a New York journalist that Salt Lake had given him, quote, the most unintellectual audience I had in America. And Deseret News fired back, calling him, quote, one of the greatest humbugs ever thrust upon the American public. They were in the most wonderful way perfectly matched. But those young men in the front row, whoever they were, whatever their names, whatever their lives looked like in that community, showed up. And I think that's really beautiful. They wore their sunflowers and they made themselves visible briefly in the dark. And, you know, Troy Williams at Equality Utah always wears a sunflower for that reason.
12 years after this, Wilde would be imprisoned for gross indecency and would be dead at the age of 46. But on April 10th, 1882, in the cathedral in the desert, he looked down and saw them and said, I see you.
That young man was always well. He planted his corn in the month of June. By July, it was up to his eyes.
There are some remarkable locals that we also need to mention that played at the theater. B. Morris Young, who we mentioned last episode, was one of Brigham Young's sons, begins performing in the 1880s in drag. He'll later take on the name Madame Petrini. He has such a convincing falsetto that audiences didn't realize that it was him, a man, performing as Madame Petrini. He performed in drag at venues across northern and central Utah for 20 years.
And if you haven't heard the story of Brigham Young's cross-dressing son and singer at the Salt Lake Theater, just check out last episode.
He once portrayed a fine Irish girl named Bridget McCarthy at a Christmas ball at the theater in 1886.
The Salt Lake Theater contains multitudes, Brian.
Yeah, it really does. One of the things that makes it a genuinely fascinating place historically is that it becomes, over time, more than just a Mormon space. Remember, the dedication speech called it the Cathedral in the Desert, but meant it really as a meeting place for all people. And over time, as Utah becomes slightly less Mormon, that's what it became. It's a neutral ground where Mormons and Gentiles, saints and sinners, could sit together in the dark and watch something human.
The Salt Lake Philharmonic Society does a production of Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore in 1879. The Salt Lake Opera Company starts, and by the 1880s, the theater is doing full operas. And politically, this is also the period when Utah's statehood struggle is at its most intense. And so the federal anti-polygamy legislation is tightening, and the theater becomes a site for some of that political combat too. The theater hosts political conventions, both Democratic and Republican, in the early statehood era. It hosts a lecture by George Francis Train, and by the 1890s, as Utah approaches statehood in 1896, the theater is one of the things boosters point to as evidence of the territory's civic maturity, so that PR move actually works out. This building that Brigham Young built partly as a rebuttal to Eastern mockery ends up being part of the argument for why Utah deserves to be a state.
And with all that said, the theater really never made a lot of money. And this is a recurring theme throughout its existence. It's chronically underfunded, never great at turning a profit. Only 11 years in, 1873, Brigham Young will sell his interest in the theater for $100,000. It changes hands, it struggles, it's reorganized in 1879 as the Salt Lake Dramatic Association. Then a competitor theater, the Walker Opera House, opens in 1882 and takes business away. The Walker burned down in 1891, which provided some temporary financial relief to the Salt Lake Theater, but even after that, it barely broke even. Then, as the 20th century arrives, everything changes. Two things will kill the legitimate theater in America in the early 20th century. You've got vaudeville, and you've got the motion picture. Vaudeville, on one hand, is cheaper to produce, it's more broadly accessible, doesn't really require the same infrastructure, but then film arrives, and that is a different world entirely.
In the theater's configuration, that beautiful opera house horseshoe, those tiered balconies, that sloping English stage makes it almost impossible to convert to a cinema. It's the wrong shape for movies.
At the center of the later history of the theater is Heber J. Grant, who is the key figure in keeping it alive, but then also its decline and fall. He's a genuinely complicated figure in this story. He grows up just a block and a half from the theater. His mother, Rachel, had worked there as a seamstress after Jetty, the sledgehammer, his father, dies. As a teenager, desperate not to pay 25 cents for a gallery ticket, Heber would haul 5-gallon water cans from an alley well to give to the gallery patrons, the gods of the gallery, they were called. In exchange, he got a free ticket.
The future prophet of the church hauling water buckets to watch plays for free. That's what we call a real man.
He seems to have genuinely loved the place. In the 1890s, as he's now a rising businessman, he purchased a controlling interest in the theater to save it from an early closure. He lost probably between $30,000 and $40,000 over the following decade keeping it alive. And yet, he's also increasingly troubled by what was coming through the national booking circuit. He is kind of like an adopted son of Brigham Young. By the 1910s and 20s, Grant is walking out of performances after the first act. He is furious about what he calls, quote, the general tendency to make a heroine of a fallen woman. He describes being...
That's what marriage is for.
Yeah, that's... These guys had very specific ideas about how these things should sound and look. He describes being driven from the theater by plays that he finds morally objectionable, and then he's got to take guests with him and they sit through it. It's a great humiliation to me, he writes. The class of shows that we have to submit to on account of our being under contract to the booking agents in New York. So, he's caught between two things he loves that are now in conflict. He loves the theater. He loves what it was, and he hates what the national circuit has made it.
The theater loses money steadily through the 1910s and the 1920s, and by January 1928, it can't meet expenses. Six of the 11 seasons' productions had lost money. Quote, it is a serious question, Grant writes, whether we should not tear down the theater at the earliest possible date. We cannot afford to go on having a loss of $100,000 capital and lose money in addition. Yet he tries to save it. He approaches Salt Lake City about a 20-year lease, which was rejected quietly by the city commissioners, who don't want to be publicly caught in the middle, and he proposes a civic foundation, suggests he personally contribute, presents the idea to his fellow general authorities in a meeting and silence. Not one of the church leaders offers to contribute.
This is the interesting part about Grant. You read about meetings, and anytime somebody comes up with an idea, he will pretty much always contribute to it. And so, in April 1928, the Salt Lake Tribune breaks a story that gives its readers, in the paper's own words, great surprise and shock. The Mormon Church is selling the Salt Lake Theater to the Mountain States Telephone and Telegraph Company for $200,000. The shock of this sale rippled through the valley. Who will step in to save the day but Lindsay's alma mater, the DUP?
Let's tell me about the DUP here, because the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers are the real heroines of the fallen women of this story.
All right. First off, I've sat next to these folks at conventions. They are Daughters of Utah Pioneers. There's no "the" in the middle, ma'am.
The yes, ma'am. For the insiders. The "the's" for the insiders.
I was just
with my grandma tonight, and she is giving her lesson this week on Sacagawea.
Now, the DUP are our heroes in this story. So they're led by their president, Fanny Carrington Woodruff. They come out swinging. They protest the sale publicly. They propose a bunch of alternatives. Let's renovate the building. Let's relocate it. Let's turn it into a publicly endowed museum. They then announce they will try to repurchase it from the telephone company. Then, when the telephone company gets nervous about the controversy, announces they're going to demolish it almost immediately, the DUP bring in a contractor from San Francisco to check whether the building can actually be physically moved to another location. Pearson, this contractor, does a site inspection and comes back amazed by the structure's strength. He says he will guarantee under bond the successful removal of the building. He's not worried about it at all. Moving costs, maybe $50,000. With repairs and a land purchase, we're talking maybe $125,000 total.
My grandma, by the way, who's in her late 80s, is now using the word indigenous. Very proud of her.
It's progress.
Okay, so they make this offer, but Grant doesn't want it. He won't encourage the committee studying the relocation. He cites costs and loss of historical integrity, and without his blessing, nothing moves forward.
So all through this, you've got a real public debate happening. Letters to the editor divide sharply. On the one side, you've got progressives. We want to be progressive in the right way, where the theater stands is a great business corner. One writer says, "I am one of those imperturbable individuals who would grind up Plymouth Rock for gravel."
Wow, that man had the courage of his convictions, at least.
And then the preservationists fire back. There is a strange charm in old things, old books, old pictures, old buildings that have historic interest. Yes.
I'm with them.
Listen to those people. One writer will ask about Grant's motives directly. Quote, "Without a doubt, money is now our god." Huh. True.
Well, yeah.
This is Grant you're talking to. This is, he's going to read this carefully. True, the theater is valuable property. So is the Old South Church in the heart of Boston. Some of these people are surprisingly direct with Grant himself. A string of women who are heartbroken, as one account says, come to his office and confront him. He is stung enough by suggestions that he is acting for purely financial reasons, a ongoing question about his life and career, he starts to lose sleep. Another ongoing theme of his career.
And of Mormonism, by the way. Wow, money becomes the god. When did that happen? It happened over the theater. At one public meeting, when a church member questions the closure, Grant gets openly angry. Quote, "It is annoying to me the conversations I have to engage in about the theater and the letters that have come from people who give little or no thought to the matter," he says. "After my losing over $30,000, common courtesy would suggest those who know this not to criticize my action." I mean, he did lose real money keeping it alive. That's not nothing. But this is a don't criticize a brother. And even if the criticism is true.
It is interesting. And to be perfectly honest, if he hadn't been involved with it earlier, he probably would have died before this. And this is a moot question. But this is also not the whole story. By October 1928, the DUP accepts that the fight is lost. The theater holds one final commemorative night. Long queues at the box office. They have priority tickets for old-timers. One man claims he rode his horse from Draper, that's like 20 miles, to attend the first dedication in 1862. He's here for the last night also. That's a fun thread. The theater's long-tenured conductor, George Careless, quote, "bent with age but Spartan in manner, walks the aisle and leads the orchestra to an ovation. The audience sings Hard Times, there are scenes from Robin Hood, they do the third act of La Traviata, and Brigham Young's granddaughter, Emma Lucy Gates, is in the lead."
And Ethel Barrymore had given the most emotional public testimony in the months before. She calls the theater beautiful, a very theater, and noted its rare English sloping stage, one of only two or three left in America, and said, "I want to play here until I'm 100 years old." At the closing program, she stood before the curtain, too sad to talk, recalling that her grandmother, her father, her mother, her father, her uncle, and her two brothers had all performed on that stage. Four generations of Barrymores on one stage.
The theater's manager of 30 years, George Piper, gives the farewell speech. People have misty eyes in the audience. Then, as the demolition soon begins, someone takes a heavy black crayon and writes on the boards surrounding the demolition site, "Built by a prophet and torn down for profit."
Yikes. I mean, the memes were happening back then too. And then the wreckers begin, and this is where I think the building gets the last word. They can't tear it down. That's right. You can't tear down art. You can't. The skirts will keep on getting shorter. The engineers expected this quick job, but what they find is a building that is, in the head wreckers' words, quote, "solid as the day it was built and capable of standing," quote, "for 66 more years." Wish Sundance was built similarly. One plank alone had 120 nails in a 16-foot span. The red pine timbers are in perfect condition. The building is pegged and nailed and fitted in a, quote, "time-defying manner that defies the wrecking crew's every effort. Women whittled those pegs in the evenings after their chores were done, and 66 years later, those pegs are defeating industrial demolition equipment because that's how Mormon women do.
As a result, the guys need several extra weeks to finish what they'd planned to accomplish in days. 6 weeks after the demolition, Grant passes the old theater corner in his carriage and looks at the empty lot. He writes in a letter to his wife, quote, "One cannot regret that the old historical building could not have been preserved." The telephone company's plans for the site keep changing. First, it's a promised park, then a parking lot, then, plausibly, a gas station in the shape of a giant airplane. The Art Deco office building they'd announced as their grand vision for the site doesn't get built for another decade because there's a little thing called the Great Depression. The great modernizing force tears down a masterpiece to build a gas station shaped like an airplane.
Progress. So what did the theater leave behind? What's the legacy?
Few things. In 1940, church officials led by Grant himself will dedicate a commemorative plaque on the telephone building wall at the old site. They have excerpts from the original 1862 services. Grant looks at the empty corner and acknowledges what's gone. So on that plaque, they've got excerpts from the original 1862 services. Grant looks around at the empty corner and acknowledges what's gone. They did save some artifacts. They saved the original stage curtains. They saved Brigham Young's box seats. They have a collection of some of the vintage costumes. And all of that is at the absolute fantastic Pioneer Memorial Museum in downtown Salt Lake, which is itself a full-scale reproduction of the theater's exterior. There's your two Doric columns. You've got those same chalky proportions. They built that in its own controversy in 1962 on the centennial of the theater's original opening.
And the DUP, who never stops fighting for the thing even after they lose.
Also in 1962, the Pioneer Memorial Theater opens up at the University of Utah. Another replica. This one houses the Pioneer Theater Company. They trace their educational lineage directly back to those groups who trained and performed at the Salt Lake Theater. And one final story that I think really captures the whole arc of this place. In 1962, again, remember that's the centennial year, a West German theater company comes through to Salt Lake and visits that commemorative plaque. They decorate it with flowers. One of their members is overheard saying, "It's a pity the old theater isn't there. We from Germany can never understand how you can do away with such things in America."
The thing is, they're right. And Grant was also right in a narrower way about the finances. Both things are true. And that's what makes it a tragedy, which is forbidden in the Great Salt Lake.
As lovers of history, we come back to this Brigham Young statement. He said if he was stranded on a cannibal island and challenged to bring civilization, he would build a theater. And that's kind of what he did. He's in this desert, 1,000 miles from basically anything. The first thing he builds that was genuinely, undeniably magnificent was a theater. And for 66 years, that theater held the whole community. Mormon and Gentile, pioneer and tourist, saint and sinner, Brigham Young's granddaughter and the Barrymore family, and his cross-dressing singer son named Madame Petrini. It held all of them. And then it was gone. What remained was the scent of roses.
I want to read the epigraph that Ron Walker and Alexander Starr used to open their 1989 article about the theater's demolition from Sir Thomas More. Quote, "Long, long be my heart with such memories filled, like the vase in which roses have once been distilled. You may break, you may shatter the vase, if you will, but the scent of the roses will hang around it still." And if you want to dig further into Salt Lake Theater, we'd especially recommend Ron Walker and Alexander Starr's 1989 article, Shattering the Vase, The Raising of the Old Salt Lake Theater in the Utah Historical Quarterly. It's a masterpiece of local history writing, and we drew on it heavily today. George Piper's The Romance of an Old Playhouse House, written in 1928, is also a remarkable document. A theater manager writing his memoir of a building he loves while watching it be torn down.
You can visit the Pioneer Memorial Museum in downtown Salt Lake. Like we said, that is a full replica of the theater's exterior. If you're up at the University of Utah, Kingsbury Hall, also patterned after that original design.
And remember, the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast is a production of the Sunstone Education Foundation. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Support our work at sunstone.org. That means send us your donations. Become a monthly subscriber. And if this episode moves you, share it with someone you know who loves Mormon history, Utah history, or just a really good story about a really cool building. Also, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. And again, donate, donate, donate at sunstone.org.
Until next time. Here in my Books of Mormon's report, I feel safest of all. I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live. In a Books of Mormon's report, powered by Benchmark Books. For an extensive overview of the theater from its last manager, George Piper, see Romance of an Old Playhouse. And then for a concise history of the theater's colorful history, check out Ken Alford and Robert Freeman's The Salt Lake Theater, Brigham's Playhouse in Salt Lake City, The Place Which God Prepared. As always, you can get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Come stand with me, my darling one, among the trembling.
Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. Let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.